Hey, everybody. J.J. Cooper, Jacob Brunner, Baseball America College Podcast. I'm here to talk to Jacob. You all are here to listen to Jacob. I'll chime in from now from time to time. But we wanted to have kind of a, I would say there are three topics today. One will be very quick, which is draft signing deadline has passed. And I did want to, before we kind of dive into the main topics today, which is automated ball strike system coming to college baseball and the top transfer classes. Jacob, I did want to ask you, like, we're doing a lot of this postmortem this week on the draft pod with Carlos, but from a college perspective, now that the signing deadline has passed, any kind of major takeaways? Obviously, we are waiting to hear whether Logan Schmidt is a JUCO bandit or an LSU Tiger. Aiden Knack is back at Clemson. But I would say kind of overall, one thing that just struck me, and then you kind of take it whatever way you want to, is for all this new world that we're in, it feels like that pro teams and college players navigated it reasonably well from a standpoint of, like, there are players who did not get drafted who are draft talents because teams knew we're not going to pay you what you're going to make in NIL, or we're not willing to. But there weren't a lot of, like, oh, this guy went in the sixth round or the fourth round or the 11th round, and then the pro team discovered, hey, we're not going to meet the asking price. It worked out, I would say, as reasonably drama-free as that could go. But I just wonder what you saw about that or anything else that struck you about the signing deadline.
Yeah, no, I think that it was as reasonably drama-free as it could have been. That being said, I think that we exist in the most high drama era of the signing window. So to be the least dramatic high drama year, I don't know that that's the, you know, the title that is really all that meaningful. Ben Badler and I, in our recent podcast episode together, talked about it. There was a lot of wins to be had on the college side. I think that college coaches felt pretty good about how their recruiting classes performed, how the infrastructure performed, how it held up, as probably a better way to put it, and just some of the victories that they were able to have, be it on the high school side. You've got teams like LSU. I mean, you mentioned Logan Schmidt, and he might not be the best example, but LSU does have a number of other high school players, four-star, five-star level talents that are going to school. James Clark, a five-star, is going to go to Duke. There were a number of transfers. Ricky Ojeda, trying to think who else. Andrew Duncan going to Tennessee. Jake McCoy going to Tennessee, who decided to go to school for one more season. So I think that we saw the college game win at a pretty high rate. I don't know that I would call it a surprising rate, just with the way that the players have been compensated and how that's accelerated over the last couple of years. But I do think that any time that you have guys who are at that age where it's like, okay, when are you going to go start your pro career? And they're making very deliberate decisions to stay in school. They're not really giving the draft even a chance. That is new. Like Hunter Elliott, for example, is a 23-year-old, soon-to-be sixth-year college player. Hunter Elliott didn't give the draft a chance. He withdrew from the draft before it even started. So does that happen 5-6 years ago? Does that happen 3 or 4 years ago? No, I don't think so. Not in college baseball. And now it seems like a pretty easy decision. So I
would say not nearly as much. Jake Mangum would be an example to me, sure, of a guy who, while he did not officially withdraw, but Jake Mangum was like, basically, I'm going to ride this college route as long as I can, and then went on to be a big leaguer. So, I would say it's very rare. But the main topics we want to talk about today, you reported on this. I feel like that this has really kind of developed quicker maybe than I expected. I don't know about you, but we went from, oh, maybe someday in the distant future, automated ball strike, you know, challenge system, whatever you want to use, could maybe come to college baseball one day. But man, the hurdles are just going to be pretty significant. You know, this is not the same infrastructure as you have at, you know, Major League Baseball and okay. And then, oh, the SEC is going to experiment with it in the SEC tournament. But okay, that's the SEC. They kind of exist in a different world in a lot of ways as far as resources than most Division I teams. And then here we are, Jacob. You know, you check it out at baseballamerica.com. But Are you surprised by how quickly this has arrived as at least an option, or are you not surprised?
So I want to make something clear before I answer your question, and that is that my opinion comes from the 50,000 foot view space. This is coming from somebody who is an observer of college baseball, and I will specifically note, as an observer of college baseball at all levels. So I spend a lot of time watching, for example, the Big West Conference, and a lot of time watching the SEC, obviously, and the ACC. So I see, you know, throughout the year, the disparity that exists across college baseball. And that's the perspective that I'm coming at this from. In a couple weeks, ideally, something to look forward to if you're a regular enjoyer of this podcast, or maybe if you're thinking about becoming one, we will have somebody from the decision-making side join us on the show and talk about it from their perspective. And I think that that's important to kind of delineate, because I think that somebody on the committee, the rules committee, somebody on the NCAA side or the SEC side may have a different response than what I will have. My response from my chair is, yes, it is surprising. I don't know that college baseball at large is ready for this kind of a change. I think that there are things both in terms of the implementation of it, from, you know, who's going to make it clear what the call is in the stadium, in a stadium where there isn't a Jumbotron. And might I remind everybody listening to this, there are a lot more stadiums that don't have the capacity to be able to put up the fancy displays that you see of the correct ball and strikes than do.
I would say with that, there are stadiums where it will be difficult to have the infrastructure to have a umpire's voice heard explaining it.
And I will say that in those stadiums, the plan at the moment, at least as I understand it, is not to have the umpire saying it. There is an expectation that somebody in the press box, be it the PA, be it somebody who is assigned full time to monitor ABS, they will make the announcement. But the administration of all of that is not clean. That will be a hurdle. That will be something that I think will have a potentially negative impact at the lowest levels of college baseball. I think it has the potential to be quite messy. And then, of course, there is the technological impact and conversation that comes with having ABS. I think that if you're the SEC or you're a fan of watching SEC baseball, this will be about as smooth as you could possibly imagine it could be, just in terms of the technology is there. All of the stadiums in that conference are equipped with the infrastructure to be able to display correct or incorrect calls. It will be reasonably seamless. Will there be moments where, you know, there are growing pains, be it from a team or a player or a coach or an umpire? Of course, but that's besides the point. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about simply implementing ABS. I think the ACC and the Big 12 and the Sun Belt, which is much better equipped than I think a non-regular college baseball fan might understand, those leagues will be fine. My question again will be, how does it work if you're looking at TrackMan systems that are not properly calibrated to be able to do this? That's difficult.
That's the million-dollar question.
Right. Now, I think that there has already been some advanced conversation on that front. There had to have been. Some of which is, for example, players in leagues that opt into this will, or not that opt into this, players in stadiums that are equipped to be able to do this with TrackMan will have to be measured officially by a team physician, which, by the way, there are a whole, you know, slew of potential problems with having somebody in-house be in charge of the
Everyone's 5'4". It's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. But you have to have official measurements, and then those measurements will be provided to whatever system it is in play at that stadium, and they will adjust the strike zone accordingly. So there will be some level of kind of infrastructural support here, I would imagine, from TrackMan or Hawkeye or Yak or Tech or whatever it is, the technology that's being used in the respective stadium that it's in. But I think that when you are trying to administer such a sweeping change across levels where the resources are so desperate, it's so widely spread, you introduce the potential for problems. This came together very quickly. We saw it first introduced in college, period, in the SEC tournament. And, you know, less than 6 months later, we are at a point now where it's going to be spread across college baseball entirely.
Okay, so to break this down again, I would recommend people read the stories over at baseballamerica.com that you've written for more details on this, but there is this key point that you just made, which is okay. So the key thing that makes this much more doable than I think either of us thought is this ability to have a TrackMan implementation. At the MLB level, this has been a Hawkeye-based system, which is a different technology, same general idea, but a different way of doing it. And so...
And if I could just interrupt you real quick, it's important to state, when the SEC tried this, that was also with Hawkeye. So this was with the technology currently being used by MLB to be able to do this.
So you were working with a system that has already done it. Now, I will say, I believe I have witnessed in person a long, long ago TrackMan implementation of this, because in 2019, when the Atlantic League did the first professional experiments with an automated ball strike system, not a challenge system, by the way, every pitch, that was in TrackMan equipped stadiums, not Hawkeye equipped. So it's not like there hasn't been this is not something where this will be the first time that anyone has ever, you know, TrackMan does track where the pitch is ball strike, but you hit on like the key thing about that is that there are many more TrackMan implementations, which really is a system that I would say, while not universal across college baseball, the Division I level, but is much closer to universal than if you said, hey, you have to have a Hawkeye based system, which has more cameras, more different things that have to be installed to be operating. I would say a Hawkeye based system would very much limit how many schools would even consider the possibility of being able to be ABA, you know, use an ABS system. The minute you say TrackMan, now, as your reporting kind of indicated, now we're talking in the 200s of the 300 teams, right?
We're well over that. But by the start of the season, the estimation that I received, and this is in the story if you want to go read the whole thing, is 280 of the 304 teams will have technology in place that will be able to do this. As of, what was the date of this? July 15th, there were 264 already ready to go.
So there will be a lot more on this. We will cover a lot more on this going forward. But it is, again, it's a significant... the one last thing I wanted to touch on with this that I do think is important is, for all the hurdles we may run into with this, right? And there will be hurdles, there will be issues and all that. I will also say, at the end of the day, an ABS system is, to me, much more potentially impactful in a beneficial way in college baseball than it is in Major League Baseball. And this is not throwing shade on any umpire. We need umpires. We appreciate that there are people willing to sweat through a game where you are working a hard job that's very difficult and being yelled at by people all the time. No shade, none thrown. But it is just a simple reality that when you talk about Major League Baseball umpires, which are the pinnacle of umpiring in baseball, they have been doing this for years as a basically full-time profession, and they have to continually be graded on their ball strike calls all the way up through the minor leagues to ever get to sniff the major leagues. It is not logical to think that every umpire working a plate at a Division I game in college baseball around the country is going to be at that level. They're not. We know this. So if you are being messed up with a egregious ball strike call in a game, this is a way to help fix that. This is a way that could be potentially very beneficial in improving the caliber of the strike zone and making it more consistent across Division I college baseball. So again, from that standpoint, this could be very interesting. Go ahead, Jacob.
I'll also just say, in talking to a number of coaches, I think that, and this is kind of to expand on your point, I think that there's a level of excitement in the coaching community that this is good for everybody. The umpires will get better, as you kind of just alluded to, but I also think that there's been a growing sense of frustration over the last couple of seasons with how the college strike zone has evolved. There is a story at Baseball America from before the season where I had a conversation with Jeff Gosney, the director of umpiring for college baseball, and we had a very honest talk about it. And he basically said, It's no secret that the college strike zone has thinned out laterally and has expanded vertically. And coaches are basically saying that it's getting out of control, that the top of the strike zone in particular, the high strike, has become a lot more prominent at the top of college baseball in leagues where the fastballs have gotten a lot better. And that has been to the disadvantage of hitters. So I think that there is an element of excitement that maybe this will bring the zone down a little bit and widen it, which will, I think, in some ways lead to more offense, which is not something that I think college baseball is starving for at the moment. But I do think that that's where we're headed.
I'll also say with that, I do think that if you plucked a college baseball fan out of 2027 with this system in place and put them back in 20 with also not the other aspects improvements that have been made to the game and put them back in 2015, they would be like, I forgot how bad this was. Because let me just tell you, as someone who, again, loves college baseball, watch a lot of college baseball, but there were a lot of aspects of college baseball a decade ago, a little over a decade ago. Oh, I'm going to throw over eight times just because, like, again, you would see games where literally it would be a eight-run game. There'd be a base runner standing on the bag, but it's like, nope, our rule is you have to throw over at least once before you go home. Stuff like that. Signs that would go on for a minute between each pitch. Things like that. We've gotten a lot of things have been improved in the college baseball game. I think this is another step with that. Speaking of improvements, though, when we get back from the break, we're going to talk about the top transfer classes for 2026 going into 27. We'll do that right after this quick break.
Big second half of the season coming up. There might be a hot ticket, a rivalry series, a sold out experience that you need to get your hands on. And SeatGeek is the spot for that. You can find good pricing. They help you with the pricing. Green dot, good. Red dot, not as good. And they help you with your view of the seat for some big matchups coming up in August, September, and eventually leading up to playoffs.
Why would you not use SeatGeek? If you want to view from your seat, you want to know if it's a good seat, if it's a good deal, it has all of it on the app. It's easy to use. It's one click, boom. You buy the tickets, they send them right to you. You get them on the app, and then you can go check out whatever game, whatever you're a fan of, you can go to, whether it's baseball, whether it's concerts, whatever you're into, you can find a ticket, and you can always try to find the green dot on SeatGeek.
And for MLB tickets, you can get 10% off with that promo code we're running all season long, Territory10. That's Territory10 off your next set of MLB tickets at SeatGeek. Make sure you click the link in the description to download the app and have the code automatically added to your account so you can use it later.
So, Jacob, you've been writing, putting together top transfer classes across D1. And I don't even think we have to sell the point of how important this is now. Like, if you have a choice between killing it as far as a incoming freshman class or absolutely dominating on the transfer portal, it's B more than A now, right?
Absolutely. I think we are 100% in the era of the transfer. The best teams are transfer dependent. There will be people who will hear that and go, well, we have this guy who's been in the program for this many years. I want you to go through the list of champions over the last few years since COVID, really. Name one team that has not had a major contributor that has not come from the transfer portal. Can't do it. They're every single team these days has had a major contributor, be it in the rotation, be it in the lineup, be it both, who came from another school and ended up becoming somebody who blossomed not only into a very high-level college player, but in a lot of cases, and we will have something on this in a little bit more depth at Baseball America soon, in a lot of cases, they become really good draft prospects. So the transfer portal, critical, not even necessarily to get stars onto your side. The other aspect of this that I'll mention before we kind of dive into the classes is that if you can get older via the transfer portal, if you can increase your average roster age, you are objectively better positioned to win in college baseball. Older teams win. It is literally that simple. We have studied it. We have shown our work. That is also over at baseballamerica.com. But in short, older teams win.
You want the hitters in your lineup to be sporting beards like Jacob is right here. You don't want them to look like they can't really grow any peach fuzz yet. If you can, I'm not saying that there aren't great 19-year-old freshmen across the country, but as many a coach will say, my less talented 23-year-old will beat your more talented 19-year-old most of the time.
Now, if you can go find yourself a Sam Cozart who's 6'6" and fully bearded and at 12 years old, that's a completely different story. But yes, that to JJ and our point, older is better. Anyway, classes.
Yes, I was going to say also that my daughter is playing in a co-ed rec tennis league, and it's like she played a kid who had a full beard, and I'm like, okay, this is not going to go well. Yeah, and it didn't. So the top transfer classes. I'll tee you up, but I don't think anyone who's been paying attention is going to be shocked to hear there seems to be a very strong SEC bent at the top of this rankings.
There is no doubt about that. It is very SEC-centric at the top. If you just compile it based on who is represented in our top, we're going to say top 150. Right now at Baseball America, we have 130 guys ranked as of July 31st. We're recording this on July 28th. We'll be up to 150. So just going off of the 150 list, so some of these guys might not be public yet. You can't count this until Friday. But the SEC is dominating. Tennessee, 10 top 150 commits. That's the most in the country. LSU, 8. Texas, 7. Mississippi State, 8. South Carolina, 7. Georgia, 7. Vanderbilt, 5. Arkansas, 7. Florida, 5. Oklahoma, 5. Let's see. Missouri has 3 top 150 transfers, which I think is probably the best indication of any where the best talent is headed.
Can I ask you a question with that? I'll ask the fan question. Why is that?
Why is that for what?
Why is it that SEC dominated? And I'm going to now put my fingers together like I'm doing a sign for money.
No, it is about the money,
and facilities and all that. But
right, no, I think that the best way to put it is more resources than it is just money. I think that money would be like the very shallow version of the take, but it really is, you want to go play at a place that has a real practice facility. You want to go to a place like you go to Gainesville, Florida, and Florida's baseball athletes have access to a state-of-the-art athletics center that, all of their athletes are able to go to, and their stadium is phenomenal. And you go to, Starkville, and Mississippi State has state-of-the-art baseball facilities. And then, of course, you talk about the Mississippis and the Tennessees and the Floridas and the Mississippi States, and there is also a financial component. They are able to compensate their players better than any other team in the country can.
But the other part of it is, just to be practical about it, if the SEC's facilities were worse and they were able to still had the largest budgets to be able to compensate the players,
they'd have no problem.
Right. And that is a part of this. I want to say that there is a cycle to this, right? When you talked about earlier about ABS and you talked about not every school has a jumbotron to show a video or a graphic of whether the pitch was a ball or strike. Okay, why do some schools have jumbotrons and not? The jumbotron, most decisions to add a jumbotron is not about we want to just add to the fan experience. A jumbotron in the proper environment is a revenue generator, because the jumbotron means that now you are able to run advertisements, run promotions at a level that you cannot without that. So now you can sell higher sponsorship packages than you could before. But to get there, if you say, we've got a jumbotron, great. Okay, what is that going to be priced at? Well, if you've got 1,500 fans on a good night in the park, you're not going to get the same money for sponsorship as if you're saying, well, here in Starkville or here in Oxford or here in wherever, you're guaranteed, that you are going to have 10,000 plus sets of eyeballs staring at this every game. That means that you now have generated, you've had the resources to put something in that now is going to generate more revenue for you, which now has raised your level of game day production, which then feeds back, and it just becomes a cycle and cycle and cycle. And so that's what the SEC's done really well, is these are revenue generating facilities, because they have figured out a way to get this to where these are fans flock to these games, and that makes a massive difference.
And it does need to be said that there is a coaching element to all of this. Guys go to the SEC and they flock to the SEC. Yes, because they're going to be compensated to do it. But at the same time, it is, to your point, JJ, there's a cyclical nature to this. Like the guys in the SEC have proven that they are going to pump out the most pro talent. And yes, that's because they can afford the best talent, but they also develop players really well. Like if I'm a college player and I have the opportunity to go and play for Jay Johnson, I'm probably going to go do that. If I have an opportunity to go and learn how to pitch under Max Wiener at Texas, who's proven over and over and over again that he's going to turn you into one of the best pitchers available in college baseball, I'm going to go do that. Like there is an appeal to the level of instruction and development and the infrastructure from a baseball standpoint that's around you, the training equipment even is really important. And those things I think drives decisions too, because I do think that there are a number of SEC and high level ACC transfers who are not going to get the big bucks this year, but have an opportunity to go and be impactful players from a college season standpoint and also from a draft standpoint. And those guys are making those decisions because they are able to align themselves with a place that is going to get them to a point where they are going to be relevant prospect-wise. But yes, at its root, to answer the question, why does it happen? Because the SEC is able to afford it and because the ACC is able to afford it. That is the next conference to the SEC's dominance.
Okay, so why is Tennessee number one?
Tennessee did an outstanding job of beating the draft. I think if there's one team in the country right now that you're going to point to and say, this is what an ideal NIL era transfer portal class looks like, you're going to look at the Volunteers right now. They have 10 what will be top 150 commitments. And if you look at the top of that list, it is a lot of Volunteer orange. Brody Trost-Clair from Northwestern State, left-handed pitcher, very limited sample size from last year. He had internal brace surgery. Expectation is that he's healthy this year. They have him through 2028, unless he transfers again. Real field of spin, had good results in the short sample. He's our number three transfer. You go just shortly down the list, Jake McCoy, who was at South Carolina, one of the big helium names before he blew out prior to the 2026 season. He is going to Tennessee and did not flip his commitment and did not sign with a pro team despite being eligible. They have the number eight transfer commitment, Chris Ramirez, shortstop from Cal Baptist. Number nine, Ricky Ojeda, left-handed pitcher from UC Irvine. And then there are a number of others who are also very high up on the list. It's just a loaded and experienced group. So to kind of call back to a comment you made earlier, if you have a lot of talent, and it's a lot of older talent, draft-eligible talent that's going to stay in college, those are the teams typically that you want to focus a lot on before the season when it comes to trying to figure out who's going to have a chance.
Okay, but as you said, it's not just Tennessee. So LSU, obviously, very high up in our recruiting rankings, number two currently, and we've said they're kind of sitting there, and depending on Logan Schmidt's decision, they could go to being our number one recruiting class. It basically, we've just said, if Logan Schmidt goes to LSU, they're number one. If Logan Schmidt does not go to LSU, they're number two. Every other decision's basically been made. But on the transfer side, what stands out for them?
It's an elite transfer class, and I do think that it's important to mention that LSU has a lot to prove after the way last year went when it came to translating elite transfer potential to elite transfer success. Those are two very different things, as I think Tiger fans really got to experience last year. But on paper, it's outstanding. Angel Laya, the outfielder from Oregon, is somebody that we are exceptionally high on. We think that he has all conference potential and then, exceptional draft potential as well. He's our number five overall transfer. Landon Hood, the right-handed pitcher from Gonzaga, is our number one overall transfer. Ace potential. He's got a fastball in the mid-90s. It's a no-doubt plus changeup. He's got field of spin. It's a very pretty pitch plot for those of you who are into that kind of a thing. And then they also had some experience. Yeah, exactly. Who's not into a good pitch plot? Cade Kurland, experienced transfer from Florida. Multiple years of starting in the SEC. Is that a flashy transfer at this point? Probably not. But again, I think that goes back to, like, if you have an opportunity to add a proven SEC contributor who's going into his age 23 season, you take the grown man and you have him go play second base for you and bring that kind of senior value. They bring in some stuff, with potential. Cade Smith from South Florida, I think, is really intriguing. The moral of the story, though, with LSU is it's a deep class. They bring in some really exciting bats. Laya, Beano Waters, number 15 for us in the transfer portal from Notre Dame. He's been very good. Jason Walks, also inside the top 100 from Tulane. That's, you know, probably a pretty good guess at their outfield right there. It has an opportunity to be very good. We'll see what it translates to.
So I would say, again, with all these teams, you could say this, but with Texas, I felt pretty good about their team coming out of the postseason and what they shaped up to. Obviously, we already talked about Cozart being a key part of that, but this is a team that has that is bringing back young stars already, but now they're adding in a very significant transfer class as well.
Yeah, they are, and I think that was the expectation coming out of last year. They make it to Omaha. They have a pretty good core coming back that includes Dylan Volantis and Sam Cozart, who was a Freshman of the Year contender, Anthony Pack in the outfield, who was our Freshman of the Year. It's a deep group.
A-Rod. Adrian
Rodriguez, yep, he's back, you know, potential first-round pick. And then I think that they did a good job just kind of solidifying around that. It's a really good group of transfers, headlined by Ian Armstrong, the catcher from St. Mary's. He's our number 11 ranked transfer. He's a 2027 eligible guy. In a way, a pretty one-for-one replacement on the Carson Tinney front. Very similar player, offensively especially. It's big power. He's going to be a good and productive bat. He's very strong and big behind the plate. Lincoln Garcia, shortstop, third baseman from Texas Tech. He comes in as a former top prospect. Also 2027 eligible as a sophomore. Sawyer Solitaria, outfielder from Kent State. Big power, bigger, kind of stockier guy. Not stockier. Stockier is the wrong word. He's a taller, kind of muscly, hulking, power-hitting type. He figures to start right away. And then on the pitching side, a little bit more modest in terms of the sheer volume that they brought in. But I think that was more by what was necessary. Max Wiener has a deep group of pitchers coming back. But he brings in a guy.
It's harder to bring in a transfer if you're like, what's your role going to be? Well, we hope that you can pitch some innings on Wednesday.
Right. And that led to one Division I transfer on the pitching side. And that's Gavin King from Middle Tennessee State. He is somebody who we view as a pretty high potential transfer, though. Number 39 in the country for us. He's 6'7", draft eligible in 2027. If you're going to assign stars to it, this is a high 4-star transfer. Real field of spin, fastballs up to 99 with ride and cut. And there's a pretty good mix of breaking balls in there too.
Okay. Before we wrap this up, I will ask you, give me a non-SEC transfer class to watch.
You know, I really like what Arizona State is doing. I think that is a program that we've seen take maybe a little bit longer than expected or desired to kind of take itself out of the mud. Willie Bloomquist was 3 years of missing the tournament. Then they get in. It doesn't look great in that UCLA regional in 2025. And then 2026, again, not able to host despite having one of the most talented teams in the country. Arizona State's in the top 5 in the last, I believe, 3 years in total draft picks. But the results haven't really matched that. I think that this transfer class, though, gives them a shot to be a lot more competitive and kind of play to their potential. Jackson Hotchkiss, an outfielder from Washington, big time power. You basically pair two mega sluggers who have proven it in college baseball between him and Harrison in that outfield. Harrison probably the center fielder. Hotchkiss more of the lumbering, very strong corner outfield type. They bring in some good contact type bats. Marcos Rosales from UNLV is an interesting addition. James Hayes, a righty from Stetson, has some pretty big time stuff. He joins them, and then Alex Valentin, another standout in our top 150, left-handed pitcher from South Carolina with some good stuff. He joins Arizona State too. I think that this is a team between what it brings back with Landon Harrison, our 2026 Player of the Year, and then a number of these very high-level transfers, Jackson Hotchkiss in particular. This is a team that should contend to win the Big 12.
That is another team to watch. And that is a wrap up on the Baseball America College podcast. Obviously much more over at baseballamerica.com, especially on this. We have Jacob has the top transfer classes coming. And then we also have all the stuff about ABS is already there. And then when it comes to recruiting classes, we update our recruiting class rankings this week as well. Again, so much over at baseballamerica.com. Also do check out later this week. We will be having a special. If you want to subscribe and you're not a subscriber, check out at baseballamerica.com to make sure that you can also subscribe. We have a special deal for you. Go ahead, Jacob.
And one more thing. Make sure that you are locked in on the Baseball America socials. That's Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube. Because over the course of the next week, today being July 28th with the trade deadline coming up, we will be doing a lot of live content. So if you want to listen to us talk about baseball live instead of on a podcast, you can do that multiple times over the course of the next week. So be on the lookout for that too.
Be on the lookout for that as well. For Jacob, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.